Paper 36, section 3, which is on old single column, page 399. All right. Density of intriguing sentences doesn't let up. As we've been experiencing so far here in paper 36, you know, with those first two sections, we found lots and lots of interesting things to pursue and try to understand. You know, you recall that they were definitely trying to get us to fully appreciate, no matter what predisposition we might have about the origins of life. They were trying to get us to settle in and to appreciate the immense complexity and the immense precision of management, execution, you know, by countless creatures who have been handed this job in a long chain, starting with very high expressions of personalized deity, you know, of God, and coming down and coming down, and finally the ones that, it's put into the hands of creatures, and of all those creatures, you know, we're reading about the primary ones here that that try to oversee all of those details. So we're going to get some more of these details, and a little bit more on some of the things that we've been curious about, you know, already as we've been reading here. Let's just get started and see what they have to tell us here.
Section 3, life transplantation. Life does not spontaneously appear in the universes. The life carriers must initiate it on the barren planets. They are the carriers, disseminators, and guardians of life as it appears on the evolutionary worlds of space. All life of the order and forms known on Urantia arises with these suns, though not all forms of planetary life are existent on Urantia.
Okay, so so you notice right away, oh, they seem to be, in a sense, saying, let's kind of start the story again, just the way we started the paper, you know, that story. Look what it says again. Just like the very first sentence said, life does not originate spontaneously, they repeat it. Life does not spontaneously appear in the universes. So they obviously want to drive that point home. Let's stress it again. You know, now, you know, you see in the immediate context of the following clause, the life carriers must initiate it on barren planets. Okay, so yes, indeed, they're expecting that initially you're going, when you see the word spontaneously, you're going to think the way it's kind of used in common parlance. In other words, you know, it doesn't self-initiate. You know, that would, you know, that's why literally using the word initiate, you know, that's what we usually think when someone says spontaneously, or at least one of the things we can think when someone uses that word spontaneously, is that something is self-initiating. Okay, now that idea, like I pointed out before, has become dogma, you know, in science now, that matter is magical, you know, and most definitively, you know, when you hear me say that, you know, those who adopt the magic matter hypothesis, I mean, most definitively, you know, what's magical about that matter is this, you know, they believe that matter is such that it can self-initiate the phenomenon of life. Yeah, that out of motions of electrons and whatnot, voila, you have someone who's waving their hands and, you know, trying to communicate with you. You know, that magic matter just bubbled me up out of nothing.
Feel that way sometimes.
Okay. Now, the extent to which we are just blobs of protoplasm, you know, I mean, the fact, the extent to which we're very static, you know, in our consciousness, you know, a potted plant, you know, more vegetable than animal, just a blob of protoplasm. You might be inclined to look at a rock and think, well, you know, it's not that different than me. You know, see, part of the problem, you know, is the sad to record. The only reason that humans could hold such an absurd thought in their head that matter could self-initiate life is if there's almost no human consciousness at all present. I mean, the only human consciousness is just what's unconsciously above them and keeping their mind stable enough to hold such ridiculous thoughts in it. You know, the grace of stability that, you know, God gives us, you know, sustains us in our ignorance, in our foolishness. But other than that, they're not availing themselves of any sort of recognition that just knows that's absurd. That's illogical. Okay, now, not that much better is what that sentence implies, like I pointed out before, to a more discerning reader who knows the revelators, most importantly, are not speaking to you in a way that you can look up in the dictionary easily. If they're speaking in a way to you in a way that can be looked up in the dictionary, it's the etymology of the word. None of those definitions necessarily of the word, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, and it doesn't matter if you have a, you know, a dictionary from the first part of the 20th century or not. I mean, the key is to know, to figure out what the true meanings of words are. We're not the authors of words. Okay? God is the author of words. Words come down from the cosmos. And part of the challenge of striking step with the truth of the revelation is to figure out what the words that we've been using for centuries really mean. Okay? And the revelators are trying to, you know, catalyze that dynamic, true relationship with language, a gift from above. And so, spontaneously, of free will is what it literally means. And that's the most important thing that the revelators want you to discover. You know, they're not trying to somehow speak to the unteachable, those who believe that matter is magical. Okay, that's pointless. You know, those are the people that you just walk past because there's nothing that you can do there yet. That mind hasn't awakened yet. Okay, but those who have some faint flicker of awakeness to their mind, some sense that there's a God, that they might even be a child of that God, that there's some validity to using a word like spirit, even in our ignorance, okay? Someone who believes in free will, you know, which not even all religionists necessarily do, you know, so-called religionists, you know, that's the other side. You know, life does not appear in the universe is because the magic man snapped his fingers. Another way to say that first clause, okay? You know, it's not just purely an of the free will sort of a thing, that a creator being just thinks something, and it is. You know, and that's what, you know, that's the most important thing they're trying to drill home, to try to get some logic into the minds of those who believe there's a God, who have always had just a bunch of fairy tales to describe the natural world and their lives and their relationship to God and whatnot. Pleasing fables, as the revelers call them. Yeah, one second. So definitely, most importantly, appreciate that. The reason they're repeating it is because we're about to go into some details, and kind of on a new tack, and to let this sink in, that nowhere to be seen is some creator being doing something. It's just, he's not a character, a creator being is not a character in this play we're reading. It's creatures who have very complex jobs that they work at day and night. Beings that do not sleep, and they work constantly on all these details.
How is it, in your opinion, that these people, they all have thought adjusters, they're intelligent. What is it? What is it, that part inside you that doesn't let you get the message? Is it just that you never heard it, or
they potentially have quote unquote thought adjusters? What they actually have is a thought changer that's trying mightily and not having much success at changing anything. Until that individual's mind is changed, no adjustment is possible. That initial step of, the person, is 70 years old. You're going, they must have a thought controller. No, not if that mind is still like that of an 8-year-old at best. They've got a thought changer who spends most of its time twiddling its thumbs, waiting for something that's potentially changeable. And that's why I said what I said earlier. You've got to recognize that if someone has chosen to no longer have teachable mind, there's nothing that any spiritual agency or spiritual being or the creator of the local universe of Nebanon himself standing and talking to you face to face can do. You have control over whether or not your mind is the way it was given to you, changeable, or whether or not you're the person in the parable of the talents who has locked it down.
I'm just saying, when you say teachable, all these minds, these guys are smart, they're teachable. It's not whether they accept this truth or that truth.
But what do I mean by teachable? I don't mean that they can memorize more facts.
Well, I didn't want to get into semantics.
But that's what I mean.
I'm trying to get to the spirit.
All right, that's what I mean. Appreciate the truth of teachable. True teachability is whether or not you will change an initial assumption. Okay, not whether or not you will add epicycles upon your current set of initial assumptions. Okay, so-called teachable mind. We don't cultivate true teachable mind in our institutions of education anymore. People come in, they leave with the same worldview they arrived with. I don't want to belabor this because we'll get way off of point. But
what seems to be happening, though, because I agree with you, that every time you read about another person who basically believes that everything started from by magical, mm-hmm. They keep finding something else that I didn't know about that, or how can this be? Or a lot of them are looking at, as you mentioned last week, at intelligent design and some other things. As they look deeper and deeper into the science,
Small handful, right? We don't have to be encouraged or discouraged. This planet will get to light and life whether I'm encouraged or discouraged. It's not about me. It'll get there fine. But we have to recognize we're in a mode right now, the material comfort era, where it shouldn't be surprising to anyone that people are going to tend to have a worldview that's dominated by material initial assumptions. Okay? You don't want to think so negatively about these individuals that believe in magic matter. They're part of an evolutionary process. Okay? But you know, so separate, you know, what I was saying before from that fact. You know, I'm not judging them in some existential terms as being unfit for paradise or anything, or an immovable roadblock to enlightened life on this planet. It's just you want to recognize what the key issue is and challenge yourself to not fall into that same trap, to be very, very intelligent, but have never put your initial assumption out in front of you and given it a close examination. You know, I mean, if they actually said their initial assumption out loud to themselves, they would laugh. But that, these initial assumptions go unexamined, you know, and we're not taught to examine them anymore. And that's why smarter and smarter people are holding on to ridiculous assumptions now. It didn't used to be so. It used to be only, you know, limited intelligence that could hold on to silly assumptions, because they were taught to grab a hold of their initial assumptions as deeply as they could reach and put them out there and examine them and say, well, now, is that logical? What was that?
Same thing happens with religions.
Yeah, right, sure. Right, I mean, that's
the original
right. You just have the, you have, it's you just, and remember that that's natural. They're not defective humans when they don't examine their initial assumptions. God made you, you know, to start out as a creature that doesn't examine your initial assumptions by default. You have to choose to examine them. It doesn't happen naturally at all. You know, see, and so you have to be encouraged by those who are older than you, that this is an effort that's worthwhile. You know, they can tell you about how when they were young and they hadn't examined their initial assumptions yet and how difficult it made their life. And then they, you know, they were taught by those older than them to do this, and they discovered, this is amazing. My life, you know, is now manageable, because I'm not living on false initial assumptions that I never knew I had. I mean, this is just, you know, part of the process. Children of God don't examine their initial assumptions. Only adults of God do. Okay? Not a single children of God in the universe of universes examines their initial assumptions. You know, if they did, you would get to paradise by grace. But you don't. You get there wholly by choice. You know. So, anyway, back to the point here. Okay. So again, they're just repeating. So we're gonna put forward a worldview to you. They're saying that doesn't involve either side of your dichotomy. What you think are the only two choices: magic man or magic matter. Okay. There's reality that you can discover. Okay, so now in here, let's look at how the, you know, there's a number of little things they're tossing in here. Okay, so yeah, the title of the section is Life Transplantation. So again, stressing why they call them life carriers. That, and so they say they are carriers. So there's this definite element where they can be literally carrying, and we'll get into the details here in the next section, or in the next paragraph, but disseminators. Okay, so that I, you know, literally seminators, you know, the seeds of life, you know, that they spread them, you know, so they bring them down and they spread them across, you know, the planet, to, you know, okay, so they disseminate, and then, you know, they foster that life going forward for a long, long time, the guardians here. So they have that role. Remember how we discovered we've got, you know, a name for one of the life carriers, the firstborn life carrier, Nambia, you know, that literally means the one who goes. Okay, so we're, you know, this section we're really getting into that verb, you know, the going thing, the carrying, the transplanting. All right, and okay, so then they say that, you know, just reminding you that you've got all kinds of diversity, and don't expect, you know, that if you wrap your mind around all the life forms on this planet that you've got the local universe of Nebadon figured out, and you'll just get, you know, variations on the theme everywhere. No, I mean, not all forms of planetary life are existent on Urantia. You know, and then you can just start imagining what that means. You know, it means many, many things, all kinds of variations we can't even imagine. But
yeah. Speaking of which, listener said, what about the ET hypothesis in contact with them when they're talking about others?
Okay, well, just quickly on that issue, that's one of the things that we're going to be appreciating here about this, the reality of life. You know, with the magic matter hypothesis, if you start working, you know, deductively from that initial assumption, you conclude that life, since it's fundamentally random, you know, if you find inhabited planets, there's going to be no similarity between any two intelligent creatures, because that would be basically a zero probability event. You know, there should be nothing but difference if you start with the initial assumption that it's purely random, you know, and so, you know, one random number comes up over on that planet, a completely different random number comes up on that planet over there, etc. But that's not the case at all, because there's nothing random about life. It's designed, and it's designed in subsets, where all of the life in a local system, you know, so roughly 1,000 worlds when the system is fully developed, are all biologically compatible. You know, if you met Bob from the neighboring planet that we actually have a little bit of details about, you know, he would be very similar to you. You could procreate with Bob, because the Adam and Eve on their, yeah, the material sons and daughters on Gerasim can go to the neighboring planet or to here and procreate on either planet. Okay, they're that similar. Okay, even if they had a, you know, a very different path getting to being a will creature, you know, once they get to be a will creature, they have to be able to mate with the one flavor of material sons and daughters that we have in Satania. Period. There's no other option. Okay, so it's very similar. You know, there it's electrochemical based, carbon, you know, based life form, you know, with this basic body layout and everything that we're familiar with. You know, and they have the colored races and all this sort of stuff.
Okay. Some don't fly, some don't breathe.
Well, yeah, but that's what I was saying. That's a path that, you know, by the time they get to will creatures, they're on the ground. There's no flying will creatures. Remember, they try to point that out directly. You know, it's like, don't misunderstand us here. You know, there's no flying will creatures or swim, you know, aquatic will creatures. By the time you get to will creatures, you're on the solid ground as a bipedal, upright being. You know, you can go back and check that. Is that, you know, there's a spot that actually.
I just read it the other day.
All right. The precursors, yes. The precursors, you know, very much, you know, very close to prior. But, you know, remember, Adam and Eve don't have wings. Adam and Eve don't have gills. Yeah. Okay. Remember, all the Adam and Eves in our local system start with one pair. You know, there's a pair that starts it all. So they're all genetically the same, you know, tied together. Okay. But, you know, I mean, let's try not to get off into too much of those details, because that's, you know, way up in part three. Okay, let's try to keep the you know, we're trying to get the design and the basic, you know, elements in here first before we try to think about a million other things. All right. Just before you start reading the next one, just notice along that line, all life of the order and forms. Okay, just the fact that they use words like that, you know, they're trying to remind you of how, you know, precisely structured and regulated all this. It's very ordered, and you know, everything has definitive forms. Okay.
The core of life carriers commissioned to plant life upon a new world usually consists of 100 senior carriers, 100 assistants, and 1,000 custodians. The life carriers often carry actual life plasm to a new world, but not always. They sometimes organize the life patterns after arriving on the planet of assignment in accordance with formulas previously approved for a new adventure in life establishment. Such was the origin of the planetary life on Urantia.
Okay. So we start out with, you know, we've got these three different orders of life carriers, and you can see that they bring some of each flavor to a world, and you got quite a crew, 1,200 of them. So, you know, especially those custodians, like we said, those are the specialists. You know, they've got a thousand different specialists. So there's all kinds of, you know, minute details that, you know, they're so complicated, just this one little sector of the whole picture that it, you know, you have to have a being that's just specializing in that, you know, et cetera. So it takes a lot of those specialists to handle all the details. Okay, and then we mentioned this earlier. So, you know, they tell us that with decimal worlds, you know, with life experiment worlds like ours, they don't actually carry literally life from their laboratories to that planet. And you say, well, why not? You know, I mean, you know, so it's really different. I mean, can't they put it all together really different in their labs and cart it here like they always do? You know, see, they're wanting you to stop and reflect on that. It's like, okay, so why would that be? They're trying to get you to discover, you know, on your own, just how complex this is. Life is very much synchronized with the environment. Okay? And so, on a normal world, not only is the life that's implanted there, you know, pretty narrowly defined, but you have master physical controllers have to get the environment of those worlds very narrowly constrained as well, so the two match up. Okay, you've got a much more loosely constrained environment on this world, and they have to, you know, actually put this stuff together and get it going in situ, you know, in the environment, you know, in place. Okay, it's because this life is not independent of that. I mean, the life is in relationship with the environment. So what they're starting up, you know, they're getting it attuned to the environment as they're doing that. So they've got to do it in place when they don't sort of know beforehand, you know, what the environment is, because it's been, you know, set to the preset, you know, margins. Okay, so that's the fundamental reason why on decimal worlds they have to do it in place. Yeah, John.
I'm gonna wait. Okay. Just see, okay. Down here in 2 cents.
Okay. All right. Okay.
Don't want to ruin it.
Okay. Okay. So, and they say, but not always. Now, you know, I mean, we don't know everything. It may be more than just decimal worlds where they do it in place, but we at least know that that's part of the but not always. Okay, and as long as we're mentioning decimal worlds, you know, let's just remind ourselves we're 606 of Satania, they tell us. And they say that on average, every 10th world is a decimal world. You know, say, okay, now if it was exactly every 10th, we would be 600 of Satania, okay, because they tell us we're the 60th. Decimal world. Okay, so that just, you know, the fact that it's 606, that's showing you there's a little bit of average, see, to that. Over the course of those 60, you know, you've got six worlds that, you know, that have been thrown in somewhere where they've done it the 11th time or whatever, you know, over the course of that. And then, of course, now there's a 61st decimal world in our system, because there's 619 inhabited worlds now. Okay. All right, let's see. So there's that issue, and then let's see. So you know, and notice, you know, how they word this. So I mean, they're not actually carrying something here, but it is in accordance with the formulas previously approved. I mean, everything is all worked out. They just can't literally assemble anything until, you know, they have to literally assemble it in the environment, because the environment affects the assembly. You know, the environment is interacting with them. You know, it's sort of moving things, and they have to attune it. I mean, you know, they literally have to assemble it, you know, in a dynamic fashion in relationship to the environment. Okay. And then the other thing. Oh, wait, before we do that, you have a question?
We had a comment.
Okay.
The listener said, I didn't know that Adam and Eve don't go to a non-breather world.
Well, this is, you know, part of that big mystery about non-breather worlds, is trying to comprehend the interface. I mean, it's your first, you know, I mean, obviously you could assume that they don't have Adams and Eves, but that may be too radical an assumption. That assume that they don't need biologic uplift, but it, you know, if they do, it's a reminder. I try to point this out to people, and we'll be talking about that some. When an Adam and Eve, when a material son and daughter are chosen to be an Adam and Eve, try to use the, you know, distinction specifically there. When a material son and daughter are chosen to go to a world and be an Adam and Eve, and they're dematerialized and rematerialized, they're not exactly the same. They're downstepped. Okay? And then there's another step to that, where their offspring downstep from them another notch, so that those offspring match up with the evolutionary stock. Okay, not them, but their offspring. So, and so you wonder, it's like, well, how much variation could there be there between, you know, the Adam and Eve and their offspring? Well, I mean, just what little they've told us, there could be quite a bit. I mean, that Adam and Eve might be, you know, 8 foot tall, but, you know, they have to, their offspring have to mate with beings that are 4.5 feet tall. Okay, all, and not to mention a zillion other issues, you know, than that. So there's likely to be some huge, you know, what comes out of the Eve's womb being, you know, significantly different than them, because of this downstepping that's built into their nature when they procreate as an Adam and Eve. So you're going, wow, could it really be that much where a non-breather is born? I mean, if there's going to be Adam and Eve, that would be the means. That's what you would have to assume. Right. Right. See, so, you know, and you say, well, that just doesn't seem logical. Well, you got to remember, don't think so mechanically about procreation. If anything, what John just mentioned should remind you, when you're talking about the secondary midwares, okay, those six progenitors, 16 progenitors of our secondary midwares, you know, they tell you that, unlike with the primary midwares, there wasn't just a, you know, a super material energy system overlap that gave rise to the secondary midwares, like it was for the primaries. You know, where the prince's staff, they, you know, they were overlapping their Marantia energy systems, you know, which were very significant, and that was giving that super additive consequence was the primary midware. Okay. But they tell you at the secondary progenitors, the sex is not incidental. The material sex is not incidental. Okay, you're going, so you're saying that secondary midwares came out of wombs? No, they did not come out of a womb. They were not born babes. But they tell you that the material sex was indispensable component of the super additive consequence. So just think about that, what that's telling you about what you think of as just a mechanical phenomenon of material sex. It's not. There's some sort of an energy system overlap that's going on there, that when it's more definitive, literally, you know, gives partial rise to another being as an adult, those secondary midwares. There's something very mysterious that we know nothing of, very profound, okay? See, it's in the fact that there's so much more to energy, the energy systems, the energy spectrum, than we understand, that allows there to be this versatility, this variability potential in things that we just can't imagine from a tinker toy mentality, you know, of a human body, you know, that we're just a bunch of toothpicks and, you know, and styrofoam balls glued together like we, you know, saw in our high school chemistry class. Okay, it's, you know, it's something very profound, and we'll get into that more in a little bit here.
So, you know, you mentioned a few times about the environment when it's, when they're here originating life being an important factor, etc. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, when they first initiate life, it's teeny, eensy weensy, you know, and I'm just, you know, yeah, I'm sure they got everything in there, but I'm just wondering how the environment has an effect on something that at that stage, or is it something they realize they have to plan for because the things are going to happen to them?
The most significant thing about the environment is the environment that current science just knows nothing of. The sub-electronic environment. You know, how do I know that? It's because the revelators tell us that when they, you know, in the first papers about, you know, historical geology. You know, they point out that that spatial environment, that sub-electronic level environment, is very, very important. It's like, why? Because those very fundamental energies are not that different from the kind of living energies. Those very fundamental dead energies are not that different than the living energies that are involved in life. Remember, when we went through the master physical controllers, there's 10 different forms of energy, 7 dead energies, and 3 living energies. Okay, and giant question marks about all of that, what all that means, and everything. Okay, see, they're dealing with issues that we can't even imagine right now about these subtleties that are going on, and everything. Okay.
It's hard for me to envision it.
Right.
The other way.
Right. Yeah. It's not about, you know, how many cosmic rays there are, even, you know, let alone, you know, how what the temperature of the jiggling air molecules is, you know, and these sorts of things. I mean, you know, we're talking about environmental questions that we don't comprehend. Yeah. You know, the things that the master physical controllers, especially, you know, specifically the mechanical controllers, are doing to create a cocoon. In which inhabited planets are going to exist. You know, they have to shield the sub-electronic environment to a certain degree, you know, or it'll rip life apart. You know, if the mechanical controllers that have this cocoon called Monmasha, you know, in this solar system, if they let go, we would all die in very short order. You know, we would unravel in the sub-electronic environment that's outside of that cocoon. It's not habitable. Okay, we're dependent every second on their perfect maintenance of this environment that we're in. Okay. All right. Let's see. Did we? I can't remember now. There's a biggie that we've got to talk about in there before we go to the next paragraph. We keep getting off on these tangents here. Okay. Life carriers often carry actual life plasm. Kate, think deductively. What does that imply? I mean, okay, what do you know about going from point A to point B in the universe of universes? Like, well, I know I can, when I'm a rancha being or a spirit being, I can be in seraphimed and, you know, carted around. But I know that, for instance, they can't transport a material son and daughter as a material son and daughter. They have to dematerialize them. You can't transport matter. Okay?
They must put it in a good jar.
So, what are we talking about here? Okay? Now you could say, well, maybe you can dematerialize it and rematerialize it. Well, that life plasm, okay, that's a possibility. However, every indication is any type of dematerialization, rematerialization, you don't get exactly what you started with. There are things that are severed in that process.
Like the 100 and things like that?
Right, I mean, again, they were, you know, the 100 were not transported as, you know, they were Marantia beings. They were transported as Marantia beings, and bodies were built here for them. No material body was transported anywhere.
Okay.
Well, see, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Adam and Eve, see, they were dematerialized. transported, and that is a dematerialized energy system, whatever the heck that is, okay, and then rematerialized, but they weren't the same when they were, you know, they're downstepped. You know, it takes something away, that process. Inexorably, it takes something away. Okay, so, you know, it's like, I don't know, I'm feeling that doesn't, it sounds to me like more likely you have to literally have a material craft traveling at less than the speed of light, of course, that means, going from somewhere to somewhere else. It's just like the shrub of Edentia.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, right. You know, there's a number of times, you know, you want to kind of note where there are indications that you have actual interstellar craft, material craft, not transport angels, okay? Because they, you know, they refer to a material thing going from point A to point B, okay? So, you know, this, and you got, well, that'd take a really long time. Well, yeah, but, you know, remember the time scales we're dealing with here. I mean, if it takes many thousands of years, that's a drop in the bucket, you know, when you're talking about them nurturing life for hundreds of millions of years and stuff like this. Okay, so it may step one is to literally, physically, cart this stuff from point A to point B when they're carrying life carriers.
Didn't they say that the Melchizedeks take 5 years to get here?
Well, again, see, that's, you know, well, they don't say that. You can infer that, you know, that it looks like it's maybe 15 light years from Gerasim to here because of those five-year things that keep cropping up for Melchizedek to get from Gerasim to here, it seems. Right, but see, they're being in Seraphim, you know, and going at three times the speed of light.
They're not in a spacecraft.
They're going in a craft, you know.
They're not in a craft.
No, they're being in Seraphim and, you know, and being carted here. So, yep. Right, so we don't have that issue, right? But I'm just trying to point out, you know, think about this on a non-decimal world. You know, they seem to be really stressing it, carrying actual live plasm. Okay, we're talking about material stuff here, and they tell you point blank, you cannot cart anything in a Sarah in an angel that's literally material like that.
Just think how cool their craft must be. Right. Yeah, just right.
Okay.
And what it runs on.
Okay. Right, so anyway, just want you to notice that. That's an interesting little tidbit there. All right.
When, in accordance with approved formulas, the physical patterns have been provided, then do the life carriers catalyze this lifeless material, imparting through their persons the vital spirit spark, and forthwith do the inert patterns become living matter.
To read the next one too.
The vital spark, the mystery of life, is bestowed through the life carriers, not by them. They do indeed supervise such transactions. They formulate the life plasm itself, but it is the universe mother spirit who supplies the essential factor of the living plasm. From the creative daughter of the infinite spirit comes that energy spark which enlivens the body and presages the mind.
Okay, now we're the details of this are spread out through the rest of the paper, so we don't want to try to speak to everything about this right here. In particular, in a couple paragraphs, we'll get some significant things here. Okay, now the very end. Where it says energy spark. Okay, so step one is to skip to the end of the paper and notice now some, and they say, well, you know, we've been using the word energy, don't think about that literally, okay? This, we're talking about life animation, okay? We're talking about something that is not technically an energy or even a force, okay? Talking about something very rarefied and subtle, on the same order of subtlety as personality, the existential thing that's bestowed, okay, that's not matter, mind, spirit, you know, or, you know, any other word like that you can think of. I mean, these two facts, you know, the pattern, be it energy pattern or spirit pattern, like personality, and life animation, are coming from the highest levels, transcendent of matter, mind, and spirit. Okay? Very, very mysterious, in many ways, subtle facts. Okay? But as they slowly get you to appreciate in this paper, this mysterious thing that you're going to add to dead matter and make it living matter, they're going to call life animation as a general term. Okay? And they're going to get you to recognize that there's two phases to that. And it's a little confusing to begin with, because the thing that's really important to the whole issue of evolution, eukaryotic life, okay, they're usually focusing on that. And that's called that phase of the life animation is called the reproductive spark. And that's technically what we're talking about here. The other part, the living vitality, will clear that up as we go forward. But we're talking about through them, this reproductive spark, we're going to call it, is bestowed upon the dead matter, making it living matter that can reproduce. And like I said, now technically, it's not being sowed literally on dead matter. The matter is already living. It has living vitality, and you're bestowing on that. But effectively, okay, to initially think about it, just, you know, forget about the complication of the two phases, and let's just kind of imagine that fundamentally we want to take dead matter and we want to get something that's, you know, eukaryotic, reproducing, evolutionary life. And so we were just thinking about that transition. Okay? And the key thing, like they're saying, you know, that essential factor is getting this reproductive spark bestowed upon it. Okay? And once you have living matter, okay, like they're saying, it presages the mind. Living matter can be engaged by mechanical mind. Okay? Mechanical mind can't engage dead matter. But, you know, so it has to be animated first, and then the mechanical mind can engage it. You know, so literally, it first of all, the living matter presages mechanical mindedness, which in a bigger sense presages agitant mindedness, you know, and the mind that we are normally talking about. A lot of times they'll kind of skip over the mechanical mind too. And when they're talking about, you know, mind engaging, you know, if you read it, it's like, oh, they're talking about agitant mind. Oh, technically, there's a mechanical mind. But see, they're glossing over that detail, just like they're glossing over the detail of the more fundamental phase of life animation right here. You've got to be aware of that, that they don't try to get you to grok all of this all in every sentence, you know, especially the first sentence that they're talking about.
So are you saying that life okay. exists prior to life?
I'll explain that.
Prior to the spark?
There were living things on this planet prior to 550 million years ago. Okay. We'll explain that in a minute.
Oh, I was talking about the second paragraph, sorry.
Okay. Okay, but the important thing about, and I mentioned this, you know, when we were talking about the life carriers and the three different modes of body, you know, they can be in. Okay, when they're in this electrochemical level mode, a mode that can directly interact with material things, so that they can construct these structures, these material structures. This reproductive spark can be bestowed. And it's important, see, this reproductive spark is a phase of life animation that's not just mother, but mother and spirit together have to bestow this spark, this reproductive spark. And that's why you have to have a creative mother spirit who has relationship to the, you know, mother deity and spirit deity together. Okay, so that's technically why it's here. It's that's the spirit deity is part of the creativity of deity, that functional level of total deity. Okay, and you need that creativity. So what do they mean by spark? They mean the essence of the creator touching it and giving it the beginnings of what you would call creative likeness, creativity, okay? Okay, so so you know they're doing all this. See, when the physical patterns have been provided, so they've got them all together, and then you get this this bestowal, and we'll get a little bit more about it in a minute. Let's see, is there anything else in there? No, let's keep going here and get some more on this.
In the bestowal of life, the life carriers transmit nothing of their personal natures, not even on those spheres where new orders of life are projected. At such times, they simply initiate and transmit the spark of life, start the required revolutions of matter in accordance with the physical, chemical, and electrical specifications of the ordained plans and patterns. Life carriers are living catalytic presences which agitate, organize, and vitalize the otherwise inert elements of the material order of existence.
So they're giving you a little idea. See, when they're in this electrochemical level mode of body nature, you know, it's a very, you know, holistic engagement that they're doing that is actually, you know, leading to the construction of this. They don't have like micro tweezers. You know, you notice they're trying to get you, you know, they, they're catalytic presences, okay, that agitate and organize. And so within their presence, you know, this gets assembled, you know, and that's only logical. I mean, you're talking about assembling how many atoms in a precise fashion, right? See, so to do it, you know, part-like is ridiculous. That's an absurd thought. You know, there has to be some sort of a holistic engagement where all of them are orchestrated together so that the pattern is within them. So you can think about, they have the pattern in their mind. And in this form, that pattern is literally getting translated into their physical energy body. You have a very intimate mind-body interactive and then matter-to-matter interactive phenomenon here where the pattern in their mind is literally being imposed directly, interactively upon the material, okay? As opposed to I'm thinking this and I got to make my arm move to, you know, to follow what I'm thinking. And that's not the way it's happening, okay? So it's a very direct imposition. The master physical controllers work the same way, you know? They put the pattern in their mind, and it takes literal energy expression in their body, and that just moves things, does things. Okay, so the life carriers are in a similar mode like this, a controller-like mode, where they have this active presence that can impose pattern on matter. Okay, now the other key thing there is. We've seen this in other situations. They're trying to emphasize that when they do this, they're setting their personality aside. When they're in this mode, it's important that they're just a means, an energy means to an end. They can't be imposing their absolute unique purposing as a particular personality upon it, okay? This is not about their purposing. This is about being the means for higher purposing. Like we've talked about, purposing that goes all the way up to the architects of being. Okay? It's those persons, those super persons, if not even higher than that, purposing that needs to get manifest down here, on a material world. So just like in order to get the contact personality thing to work. It's only when they can find an individual that just sets their personality off to the side so they can use the energy, energies as a conduit. Okay? If there's any personality purposing that inserts in that, then it doesn't work. So you see the life carriers are doing a similar thing. They're sublimely, indifferent as a person to this phenomenon. They just let it happen through them. Okay? The patterns that they've memorized take form in their presence, just like they were told to do, not one molecule out of place. All right, so that's that kind of very humble attitude. That's why this can work, why creatures can play the role that we've always given to God of bringing life into existence, because of their complete humility, their complete ability to step back out of the way. Huh, that seems to be speaking truths to me as well. I mean, the only way I can be God's hands is if I get out of the way, right? It can't be about my will. Notice that element that has very immediate personal consequence. All right. And then the other little thing is a little bit about the universe of motion is tossed in there. And they speak of revolutions of matter. We're moving towards paper 42. Where we're, they're wanting us to think a little bit about the physical world and, being very different than anything we've ever imagined. So not the billiard ball model. So not static. It's fun. Everything is a motion. Not things in motion. Everything's a motion. And when you're talking about something that you want to call a thing, that cup just seems to be sitting right there. It doesn't seem to be a motion that's screaming across space. It seems to be bottled back on itself. Yeah, like a revolution. Okay? See, motions that are fed back on themselves so that they, when you step back, they don't, you just see the center of the revolution. You see something that appears to be static. But if you zoom in, everything is dynamic. Okay. So their mind is a motion, and it's imposing motions, in the physical domain. Everything is a stir, just like the beginning of Genesis, see? They're trying to get you to appreciate the truth, of those initial sentences in the first chapter of Genesis about things being a stir. In a catalytic presence. Okay? There's a truth to that. All right, yep.
One listener said, do we as mortals need to step out of our personality in any fashion or way to?
Now remember, it's an active thing. We know that we've been trying to, they're trying to teach us it's to not go to the negative, not my will, okay, but yours be done. It is my will that your will be done. Now the way that works, very much when you're getting started, those favorable conditions, you're using your will to allow growth to just be possible, rather than trying to build yourself. You're gonna allow God to grow you. See, so the will, it's active, but not in a building sense, in a favorable condition sense. You're actively keeping your ignorance out of the way so that you can be grown. Now, the more you ascend, the less ignorant you are, and the more you can be right in there, in the fray of things, and not be getting in the way. But right now, if I'm going to be able to put forward words that have some thread of truth to them, I have to get ignorant animal origin Chris Halverson out of the way. I've got to try to just let an intuitive relationship to the cosmos find word. And you're not channeling anything or anything like that. That's not what we're talking about. You're not meddling in things you're ignorant of. You're knowing when to be humble, and when to trust and let things happen. Okay, naturally. Yeah, was there another thing?
Yeah, second one. Are these the same person, universe, mother, spirit, and creative daughter of the infinite spirit?
Yes. Right. You have all these different names for the consort of the creator son, depending on what you want to emphasize. Local universe mother spirit, creative mother spirit, divine minister, a creative daughter of the infinite spirit, all these different, they're trying to remind you there, you can say, why did they say, creative daughter of the infinite spirit? Why did they say it that way? Because they want to remind you that she's a conduit as well. Okay, this spark is coming down fundamentally from the infinite spirit. And she's just the means, the local means to that bestowal. Yeah.
Another, a different listener said, it's interesting why a female god gives us the energy spark and not Michael directly.
I mean, there's all these issues about that. I mean, understanding the difference between when they're calling deity father and when they're calling deity mother. I mean, it's not because, don't think of it anthropomorphically. We're talking about presences here in bestowal. Fathers don't have presences. Only mother deity has a presence. The father deity is outside and can't be present. So fundamentally, when you're thinking about something manifesting ubiquitously, like the spirit of truth being poured out upon all flesh, he can't do that because he's not ubiquitous. Okay? She is. He hands it to her and she spreads it horizontally because he is not horizontally ubiquitous. He's here or there, not everywhere at the same time. Okay, anything like that. I mean, if you talk about those power beings, like I was just mentioning, doing something in a presence fashion. See, that's reminding you of their heritage. Their offspring of the infinite mother spirit. So that they have this ubiquity phenomenon as part of their nature. Okay. Okay, now look at this fascinating little tidbit that they throw in here.
The life carriers of a planetary core are given a certain period in which to establish life on a new world. Approximately 500,000 years of the time of that planet. At the termination of this period, indicated by certain developmental attainments of the planetary life, they cease implantation efforts, and they may not subsequently add anything new or supplemental to the life of that planet.
Okay. Now this is a very interesting little tidbit that they throw in here that could definitely throw you for a loop. Because there are a number of places in the Revelation that on initial comparison would seem to be in contrast to this. Okay? You can probably remember spots in the book where they speak about the life carriers getting everything all set up, and then instantly the spark being bestowed, and then them being put back in their mid-phase mode. Okay, that's what you notice initially as you're trying to remember all the things that the Revelation tells you. You pick up on that, and then you're reading this, you go, what? Approximately 500,000 years? That doesn't sound like instantaneously to me. What are they talking about here? Okay. They say developmental attainments. Okay. I thought that that the instant you had a living thing, so that it could be developing, they've been reverted back and I've got to carefully parse this out for you, so you can understand what's going on. Okay, this is where you have to have recognized that you have these two different phases of life animation. Like I said, we don't literally get them referring to that until later in the paper, but you've got to bring that here to understand this. Okay. So they tell you that just in their normal mid-phase mode, and always, they bestow the living vitality, that first phase of life animation, that just naturally, no from the creative mother spirit or anything to that. That just gets bestowed directly through them. Remember, and I told you that's why they, one of the reasons why they need the Ancients of Days and one of the Ancients of Days as a parent, so that there's that Trinity origin, there's that mother conduit. The mere living vitality phase of life animation doesn't require that spirit association like the reproductive spark does. So just the Trinity origin, you know, mother nature that they have, you know, separate from mother and spirit together, that other parent of theirs, the creative mother spirit. But see, there is no spirit together with the Ancient of Days. That's just Trinity origin, mother-like nature. So it's a conduit where you don't have spirit associated, and this living vitality can be bestowed. The all the rudimentary animation of my body is done by the living vitality, that first phase of life animation. It's only the more complex things, more immediately related to reproduction, that require this additional animation nature of the reproductive spark. So how this technically works is, let's bring in a little bit of the history. That's, you know, we're picturing this on our planet. Let's bring in a little bit of the history. 950 million years ago, the primary associators, that type of master physical controller that are called primary associators, arrived on the planet. If you go back and read at 950 million, you'll notice that, you know, they talk about being put in life registry, you know, because there's now beings, there's primary associators on the planet. And they're there to begin the terraforming process of the planet, getting the planet ready for eukaryotic evolutionary life. Okay? And they build machines in their image to do this. Okay? Prokaryotes, little, you know, bacteria, you know, that kind of non-nuclear, you know, there's no nucleus to that cell, prokaryotic life. Things like cyanobacteria to make an oxygen atmosphere and all kinds of things like this, things that terraform the planet. Okay? They build those material structures. Okay, but they can't bestow any life on them. They're dead. It's just dead matter. They assemble what they want to use. And then 900 million years ago, remember, there's a scouting party. In that scouting party are life carriers. Okay, those life carriers, you know, arrive, and just in their presence, their normal mid-phase presence, life animation, the first phase, that living vitality, is bestowed upon these structures that the primary associators built, and you now have living prokaryotes, living machines. They're going to start chewing on the planet and, you know, reworking it. Okay, as I go into my paper about the history of life. In order to sync up these events with radioactive dating, radiometric dating, you have to recognize this subelectronic environment and the issues that decay hasn't always been at the same rate. Decay used to be at a lot faster rate in this environment before the master physical controllers clamped down on it and made it habitable for very delicate living structures. And so when you're talking about what the revelator is saying is actually 900 million years ago, there's a factor of four difference. Okay, in the radiometric date that you'll get, 4 times bigger radiometric date. 9 times 4 is 36. Okay, 3.6 billion years ago. Okay, and that's exactly what you find. The very first evidence in the fossil record of prokaryotic life, long before there's any evidence of eukaryotic life. But the evidence of prokaryotic life, see, it matches right up with what they tell you. That's when those life carriers started the machines going, started terraforming the planet. What we think is 3.6 billion, but is actually just 900 million because our radiometric dating isn't calibrated properly. Okay? Okay? So, yes, there's when the life carriers arrive here 550 million years ago, okay, you've had prokaryotic life for a long time. Okay? One of the things that happened just a little bit prior to them to this 550 million years ago event is getting the cyanobacteria really going and getting oxygen production in the atmosphere and things like this. Okay. So there's all of this stuff that they're laying the groundwork. There is life, but it only is life, prokaryotic life, only needs the living vitality and mechanical mind. Okay. Prokaryotes, things like bacteria, do not reproduce. Okay? They're trying, you know, the scientist will say they do, but he's misusing the word reproduce. They produce copies of themselves. They don't reproduce. You have to ask yourself, why do we stick the prefix on that? Why don't we just call it production? Why do we call it reproduction? What does the re mean? Okay, it's something different. Okay, so now that living vitality and the mechanical mind that it engages that living matter goes all the way from very rudimentary levels to much more complex levels. Okay, and so here they are. It's 550 million years ago, and they're on the planet, and there's living vitality. You know, in play. They assemble these initial eukaryotic single-celled plants. Remember that they're going to start with single-celled plants. Okay, you know, not a prokaryotic cell, a eukaryotic cell, you know, with a nucleus and all the machinery outside of that nucleus. They're going to build those complex machines. Okay, and the life animation is right there with it. For instance, you know, you have to have a mitochondrion, a power plant in that cell. That's a prokaryote, you know, that needs living vitality and mechanical mind to make it go. Okay, so they're extending that. They start out with this whole eukaryotic system that has no reproductive spark, but it's alive, just like they tell you they do in their labs all the time. Okay. They build this whole system, and they've got to get it synced up with the environment and everything, and let the process of how, you know, when mind engages the matter, you know, there's a process that starts to happen. It starts to change. Okay, there's a developmental process, you know, that occurs. And so, for 500,000 years, you now have a eukaryotic cell, but it's not in reproductive mode yet. It's just there's just living vitality, and they're getting the initial part all in place. Okay, and then once it reaches some critical stage that we can't understand right now, of development, you know, in terms of everything sort of all of the precursor stuff getting in place, everything is synced up, all of the living vitality and the mechanical mind and everything is all properly tuned into this system, and they're given 500,000 years to tinker with this and get it properly tuned up. Once it's all properly tuned up, then this reproductive spark engages, and instantly after that, they are taken out of the electrochemical energy body mode and put back in their mid-phase mode. See, but they're telling you here, this is one spot where they're telling you that there's about a 500,000-year stretch before that instantaneous thing that you often read about. just like I've pointed out, there's several hundred million year stretch before life implantation. Yeah, I mean, and you know, and if you're not sure about that, go back and read what it says on 900 million years ago, that we were put on the life registry all the way up the hierarchy 900 million years ago. It's like, well, if there's no life on the planet, that doesn't make sense. Okay. You're put on the registry because there's prokaryotic life then. So you have all these precursors. Like I said, a lot of times for simplicity, they don't bring in all the complexity. Like they'll set aside mechanical mind and just talk about agent mind as something being minded. Or they'll just focus on the reproductive part and not bring in the living vitality, just to keep it simple, you know. Or they'll just talk about eukaryotic life and, you know, set aside prokaryotic life just to keep it simple. You gotta figure that out. And you don't recognize that you have to sort all that out until you start noticing, wait a minute, this passage seems to be in disagreement with this passage. And you got it, okay. And then, you know, you work at it, you look for other clues, and you find, oh, okay, now I'm getting it all together. So you've got to appreciate they don't, the book is not constructed in a mindless fashion where you can just teach a computer to understand the significance of the sentences. Okay, you got to be actively thinking about what things they're expecting you to just understand or in play, even though they're not explicitly talking about them.
Yep. Can you remind us where the metric periodic dating references in the book? Times four.
Well, that's not in the book. That you have to figure out deductively again. You know, and how do you do that? You just go through that history of life paper that I wrote. I mean, and I step you through that. You know, it's a matter of just recognizing that we have two series of dates. We have the dates in the book, and we have the dates that we've deduced by radiometric dating. And they're, you know, don't match up the numbers. That's mindless. You can teach a computer to match up the numbers. Match up the events. You know, the Rancho book says such and so event occurred at this date. Well, scientists know about that event. They say it occurred at this date. You know, so they're talking about the same event. Match up the events. You know, and then notice there's a pattern to the numbers. The numbers aren't randomly related to each other. It's not like scientists have just random false numbers. They have a rational system. Yeah, and you line them up, and it's like, oh, would you look at that? For that whole stretch, they're off exactly by a factor of four. You know, and then some things start to change and stuff once life is implanted. So, you notice there's a systematic relationship between the two.
About radioactive, blah, blah, blah.
Well, they talk about radiometric dating.
Where is that?
I'd have to go. It's up in part four. I mean, part three, I mean. You know, you can find it. Just look for, you know, radiometric dating. But, you know, they point out that the radiometric dating is precise, but it's not accurate if it's not calibrated properly. And we have no way to calibrate it without the revelation. Okay, remember? You know, so they say, you know, that dating system you have, okay, I mean, that's great for getting you know, precision, but you need to calibrate it, and we'll give you what you need to calibrate, because you can't do that yourself. You can't know what the sub-electronic level environment was, you know, 500 million years ago or a billion years ago. We have to tell you that. Okay.
Yep. A little later on, you'll remember they talk about the life carriers can interfere here and there up until the time that will shows up. That's a little bit different kind of interference than what this is.
Yeah, you mean we're getting to that here next. That's actually the next paragraph.
Different kind of thing.
Right? Yeah, so let's just wait till the next paragraph to contrast what we're talking about. Here, let me just, you know, to emphasize what we're talking about right up to the point of bestowing the reproductive spark. Okay, is a very direct interactive thing. Literally, you know, the way I'm my body is interacting with this cup, you know, matter is meeting matter. Okay, you don't have just some magical being thinking something and matter moves. Okay, there is no such, you know, thing. You know, if matter is going to do something, there has to be a literal energy at eye level with that matter interacting with it. Okay. All right. Okay, now, all right, so let's see. Did we get everything there? So, Oh, well, there's just one other thing, just for specificity of understanding about what we're talking about here. If anyone has had some rudimentary biology, okay, when you talk about reproduction of eukaryotic organisms, okay, that process of producing the germ cells, the gametes, the sex cells that are going to come together and reproduce something, okay, that process is called meiosis, you may remember. Okay. Whereas, let's take the skin cells in my body. They're constantly dividing and making new ones, and old ones are dying off. Okay, that process of producing copies of the cells, that's mitosis. Okay, so you have these two fundamental processes: mitosis, which is the complicated producing a copy mechanism when you're talking about a complicated eukaryotic thing, as opposed to binary fission, which is the producing the copy when you're talking about a prokaryote, like a bacterium. Okay, but then there's meiosis, which is not producing a copy. That's a reproductive process, not a productive process. And the reason it's reproductive is because there's a fundamental element of that called crossover, chromosomal crossover, or just crossing over, where the germ cells that went into making you, one came from your father, one came from your mother. Okay, and the chromosomes in those two cells are tied to your grandmother and grandfather on each side. And you don't just get, I got grandma's chromosome number one, or I got grandpa's chromosome number one. You get a new chromosome number one that has a little bit of grandpa and a little bit of grandma in it. The grandma and grandpa ones have crossed over in part. Maybe you got one that's mostly grandma's flavor of genes, but this part crossed over from the grandpa chromosome. And you've got grandma, and a chunk of grandpa. Okay? For your chromosome number one. It crossed over from one chromosome to another. Okay? That process, that is all animated and guided, and not only that, but synchronized very mysteriously with the Supreme. Okay? That has to do, you have to have reproductive spark to animate that process of meiosis. Not to mention the mitosis gets modified. So in this thing where we have about 500,000 years, you have mitosis going on. You've got a single-celled plant and it can produce a copy of itself, okay, through mitosis, but it's going to be a pre-meiotic mitosis, prior to meiosis, this mitosis. See, because if you study this, there's an interface. I mean, meiosis is sort of a modification of mitosis. Okay, and if there's an interface, it's interactive. So mitosis is going to be different after the reproductive spark. It's going to be such that it can transition to meiosis, as opposed to being a dead end, sort of a phenomenon. So with the so when all is said and done, just to kind of keep it simple, you can think about a prokaryotic cell, since it doesn't have to reproduce, all it needs is the living vitality. But a eukaryotic cell that has to reproduce, it needs both the living vitality and the reproductive spark. That fundamentally, the significance of mitosis and then meiosis is animated by the reproductive spark. It can't be animated by the mere living vitality. That's the fundamental distinction. Whenever there are two phases of anything in what's being bestowed or what's engaging us, that leads to a differentiation in life. You know, you have a fundamental twofoldness to life on the planet. There's prokaryotes and eukaryotes. It's because there's two phases of life animation. You go to eukaryotes, and there's two basic modes of eukaryotes, plants and animals. Because plants, you know, just have mechanical mind. But animals have mechanical mind and adjutant mind. That fact, that fundamental difference, is why there's two very general divisions in eukaryotic life. And then you start to have all of the divisions within the animals, because those just have first adjutant, those just have second adjutant, or have first and second, I mean, etc.
Where within there is the evolutionary forward progress part?
Right. Right. So the evolutionary part. Okay.
You know what I'm asking?
Yes, I am. Right. And that's why the very important thing about understanding evolution is who is fundamentally evolving things. Yeah, it's the supreme, and technically it's the personal purposive part of God the Supreme. It's God the mother part. That not the father, the mother is, you know, the creative agent of evolution. So how does this purposing, this creator nature engage living things and make them evolve? Okay. It does it fundamentally through the reproductive spark animated life. You know, when you get to the point of the life implantation, quote unquote, at 550 million years ago, just if you're noticing, they're actually stressing the difference between the life that you had before that, merely prokaryotic life, and the life you have after that, eukaryotic life. They talk about launching the evolutionary cycle. Because prokaryotes don't evolve. Okay? If you look at a cyanobacteria today compared to that one that was there 900 million years ago, they're the same. Because prokaryotes don't evolve. They don't have the reproductive spark. They don't have this crossing over phenomenon that that's sort of the crude handle upon the living things that allows them to evolve. That's how the influences from above are getting a grip on it. It's how it can have the variability so that it can evolve. Prokaryotes don't have that variability, so they don't evolve. Now, there is some change that goes on, especially when you have prokaryotes interacting with eukaryotes very intimately. You know, the eukaryotic life is evolving. And if there's prokaryotic life interacting, well, they get drug along some. But the eukaryotes themselves are not evolving. They're just getting drug along by what's being evolved. So you don't want to confuse that, you know, and think that somehow prokaryotes evolve in and of themselves, because they don't. They're just machines, and machines don't evolve. They're just living machines. Okay. But this whole variability, see, is fed in by allowing things to be able to mix up, okay? And the designers here don't know where that all goes. They just set it up so that it can mix up, and they let the Supreme take it where the Supreme wants to take it. And every once in a while, they do a test, every roughly 10 worlds, just, you know, make sure they have some sense of this mysterious influence that's coming into this process. So they know how to say, not my will be done, but yours, God the Supreme. They make sure that they stay out of the way, that they design it so that their will is not imposed on it, blocking the will of God the Supreme from evolving it as it wills, as he wills, as she wills, you know, etc. Okay? And we saw that, you know, like I said, with the life carriers. That's why they mentioned that personality sees not in the way, because they're not evolving, going to evolve it. God the Supreme is. Okay. Did we get everything there? Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
During the ages intervening between life establishment and the emergence of human creatures of moral status, the life carriers are permitted to manipulate the life environment and otherwise favorably directionize the course of biologic evolution. And this they do for long periods of time.
Okay, so now, you know, there's other spots in the book where they basically say the same thing. So they're giving you this context like John was bringing up there. Okay, so when they're in the electrochemical mode of body manifestation, you know, they are literally directly, you know, energy to energy interacting with these things. You know, including that, you know, 500,000 years when you've got a eukaryotic, you know, you have eukaryotic plants, but they're not reproducing yet, they're just producing copies of themselves, and they're manipulating that very directly. So when you go to statements like this, where they say manipulate, hands on, okay, you know, sort of literally, so we don't mean literally this kind of hands on, where, you know, molecules in my hand, you know, are engaging these molecules in a direct, you know, physical energy interactive way. What do they mean by manipulate here? Here they, you know, they just mean that they can modify the environment, you know, like maybe they want these species to kind of separate themselves from those species. So they get the master physical controllers or whatever to modify the environment a little bit, and these guys go, ooh, this is like an icky place, I don't want to live here anymore, and so they scurry off over there, you know, and they find themselves in, you know, in the territory that the life carriers want them to be, so that they're not, you know, interacting with that life, or all these sorts of manipulations like this. You know, see, and that's why they say, see, permitted to manipulate the life environment and otherwise favorably directionize. Okay, so when you don't have inherent will in the system, there still has to be someone who does have will, you know, putting that overarching directionization on the picture, you know, bringing in some purposing. Okay, so that's what they mean by that. They're just, you know, in indirect ways, but they can't go, well, you know, if we just went in and changed a couple of the molecules in there, it would instinctually do such and so. No, they can't get inside, and, you know, they have to work with it, you know, from the outside, so to speak, you know, indirectly.
What about us going in and switching around?
Yeah.
How does cloning factor in?
What?
Cloning. Okay, so, you know, once you have, you know, the living vitality and the reproductive spark, you know, the fullness of life animation, present on a world, you know, then you can, beings that have will, like us, can go in and play around with this stuff, okay? And we don't have to have the ability to bestow a reproductive spark or living vitality or anything like that. It's just present in the environment, as it were. You know, every blade of grass, you know, in your lawn has, you know, all of that life animation and mechanical mind bestowed upon it ubiquitously, you know, it's just present throughout your lawn, quote unquote, right? You know, it's just a present in the environment, and, you know, and it gets everything it needs. So we can definitely get in and start playing around with it. It's like, well, why would they allow that? Wouldn't that be playing God? Or at least pretending that you're a life carrier, okay, who are the hands of God, the manipulators, literally the hands of God. Well, remember, there's another thing that comes into play here. All of the really fine refinements of life on a world is done manually. It isn't done by sort of just the gross evolutionary phenomenon. I mean, the first time when you really see that is when an Adam and Eve arrive as biologic uplifters. You know, when the Supreme has taken things as far as it can within that vessel, quote unquote, they come in and modify the vessel so the Supreme can take it further. In order for the Supreme to take us all the way to a being that can be enlightened life, something completely beyond our ability right now, we're way too genetically crude to be a light and life being. We can't be minded like you need to be or anything yet to be enlightened life. So there's all of this modification of the vessel, so to speak, you know, to fit the bigger stuff in that. We don't have enough, we don't have the capacity right now. Most of that refinement beyond these initial crude levels is done by genetic engineering. Right? The beings on the planet, you know, genetically engineer the mortals, you know, and maybe animals come into this too. You know, they don't explain all this in great detail, but very much so. All of the major stuff beyond, once you have Adam and Eve's life plasm fully dispersed through the whole population and everything all assembled into one race, everything after that is done artificially. It's an art form. It's done by genetic engineering. So it's not wrong that will creatures engage genetic engineering. That's part of the process. We have to start to learn this. And eventually we're going to have someone who's going to teach us, you know, how to do this well, like normally Adam and Eve are supposed to, you know, teach the mortals how to properly genetically engineer themselves into light and life.
They're not coming back.
Well, I remember that's the whole mystery about, you know, how this is going to happen. You know, that's why some people think that Machaventa is also going to take on, you know, he's going to come in corporeal form.
That's what we have
as, right? That's why we have to have all of these things that we think of as evil right now and love to throw them out as, you know, words like that, dripping with evil. Okay, but actually, that's the future. You know, that I mean, you know, we have no idea. I mean, we're talking about genetic engineering everything. You know, we're just beginning to play, and we think it's somehow. No. Wait until we, you know, change everything. Every single chromosome in your body is going to be completely changed by genetic engineering, because it's not godlike enough yet. Okay. And God doesn't make it that way. Creatures do, just like the life carriers.
Better hurry up.
See, to appreciate that this gets handed off. The reason that the life carriers, you know, once there's will, have to either leave or, you know, be modified again and take, you know, vows to not, you know, engage anymore, because the personality management has shifted hands now from them to us. I mean, we're the personality management. Yeah, so all the way down to the minutest details of our DNA has to all be personality managed when we're enlightened life. It's nothing automatic about it. It's not spontaneous. No magic God the Father has already made us light and lifelike. I mean, we're as far from it as you can be and still get there by the Father's hand. Okay, the mother's hand gets you the rest, you know, most of the way, and then we have to jump in and literally do it ourselves.
Chris, I'm going crazy.
So we're right now, our skills are so poor,
right,
that our idealistic mind is getting cranky about that.
Yeah.
But we need to be a little more far-seeing about it and understand that, yes, we're, you know, fumbling around in the dark right now, and some of the things that we're coming up with aren't real great, but down the road we'll somehow, I imagine, get really good at it.
Right. We'll get help.
Didn't help at all.
But see, but Do you see, but again, to see that, I mean, you know, we could say Lucifer did nothing but not help, but no, that's not true. What Lucifer, you know, in the wake of Lucifer,
I didn't say Lucifer.
I know.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm just expanding. You know, I'm seeing your Hitler and raising you a Lucifer. Okay. I mean, why go for Penny Annie? okay. I mean, just. I wanted to make this point, so you just kind of teed it up. The design that the life carriers did is such that if there is a rebellion and a default, and humans are ignorant and have technology, coincidentally, we can't take things way out of, you know, off into left field. The extent to which we, you know, let's imagine we could, that we could do things with genetic engineering right now in our ignorance that could, like, make it so humans are no longer fertile. You know, that's a great science fiction thing that a lot of people are making movies and books about, you know, those sorts of fear sorts of things. You know, that humans with their genetic engineering are going to do something and, you know, either kill off, you know, humanity or make us infertile or whatever. Okay? You know, let's say there was that level of ability. Well, there would be intervention of some sort. It wouldn't be allowed. But I can tell you that, you know, remember, the universe is designed so that intervention is seldom needed. You know, that's a point that they try to make, try to get us to trust the integrity of what's been designed and built.
It can only go so far astray.
Right. I mean,
it's, yeah, built into it.
Our ignorance is coarse, not fine. So, you know, you can pound on things, you know, but to actually fundamentally disrupt it, you have to have knowledge that's beyond anything that we are capable of, not to let alone machines that we can't even, you know, construct yet, you know, relating to sub-electronic level energies and all this sort of stuff. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, if we literally had the Star Trek transporter, okay, now that would be genuinely dangerous. You know, that would mean we'd have a level where we could actually do significant damage to ourselves. But pounding on ourselves with, you know, coarse tools, no, and our ignorance right now. I mean, it has a robustness that's, you know, much finer than that, okay? But, you know, the life carriers do have the ability to engage things like that. That dematerialization, rematerialization thing is effectively the Star Trek transporter. Yeah, and that's mind-boggling technology. I mean, you know, when I first started reading this, I had already recognized that the Star Trek transporter, of all the Star Trek things, you know, that was completely absurd. You know, there couldn't be such a thing. You couldn't, you know, turn a being into energy and then reassemble them. That was ridiculous. You know, then you're reading and it's like, oh my goodness. They tell you there actually is beings who can do this. So, you know, but we don't have that level of, you know, understanding.
What about the possibility of, say, a global thermonuclear catastrophe?
Right. Again, all these things that we can be afraid of. I try to point out. I mean, if there is any genuineness to our fear, you know, if we actually could do something that was genuinely significant to ourselves, it wouldn't be allowed. Okay, but, you know, nuclear weapons are trivial. I mean, one big stratovolcano, I mean, you know, Krakatoa going off, that's more than every nuclear weapon that'll ever be built on this planet going off at one time. I mean, you know, nuclear weapons are trivial, okay? I mean, you blow up a hydrogen bomb on an atoll in the Pacific and you can still go to the atoll. It didn't vaporize the seamount, okay? Giant stratovolcanoes vaporized seamounts, okay? I mean, not to mention master physical controllers, okay? I mean, how many mechanical controllers do you have on the planet? How many beings do you have on the planet that literally can manipulate stars and you know, and tracks of galaxies. And I mean, our fears are so ignorant. Okay. And they're not founded on any potential, you know, of truth. I mean, the universe is mind made, personality managed, and the Most High is ruling the kingdoms of men. Okay. And I mean, humans are trivial phenomena in that scheme of things. We need to stop exalting ourselves into gods, you know, and believing that we somehow can, you know, radically alter things so that, you know, it's
arrogance. Yeah,
it's just arrogance, right? It's not going to happen.
I just want to make sure I heard you right.
Mm-hmm.
About the biotechnology,
mm-hmm,
being one of the leading things that are being handed over from the life carriers to the human hands, which basically means our biotech companies like Monsanto, mm-hmm, and other companies like that. They are going to bring us genetically into the
ignorant humans, you know, with monikers, you know, on their buildings are not going to get us to light and life. But genetic engineering is. Just recognize if you want to be encouraged that light and life is not an eternity away, the fact that humans are starting to investigate genetic engineering is a hopeful sign that the new age is beginning to dawn on this planet. We now have creatures on this planet who can comprehend the kind of things that take you to light and life, like genetic engineering. How recent is that? Not very. Yeah, I mean, not very. I mean, how very recent? Yeah,
very,
yeah,
recent.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just to see these things. Don't see them for their potential negatives, because in truth, there are no potential negatives. We're not allowed to impose actual negativity on the universe of universes, you know, in any grand sense. So, you know, we're getting started, you know, and once we finally have a bit of understanding, coincidentally, beings will show up and they'll say, you know, those techniques that you developed, let me show you how to use them a little bit better.
Okay.
But we're still going to be doing it.
Yeah.
There will be a corporation, an institution on the planet, you know, that will be working on re-engineering the human genome to make it more Adamic-like.
Yeah, the tomatoes, I mean, right now, I'm just thinking about what we have right now. They're making seedless plants.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's scary to a lot of people, because then you have to buy your seed from Monsanto. But
yeah,
when you were talking about being infertile, making infertile humans,
yeah,
look how many people are having to go to their fertility clinics to just have a baby.
Right. Okay, so just put this in the Arantibuk context. You have a baby, let's say, or a little child that dies at age 2. And that child gets resurrected in the probationary nursery. And the beings that build a body for that child, a material body, make it so that it's not reproducing. I mean, see, let's appreciate, this is what we're talking about, going into a domain where that's one of the things you can do. You can build bodies that are not reproducing. One day we're going to have that knowledge. That knowledge that can build bodies for, you know, planetary princes' staves, and can build bodies for children on a probationary nursery. You know, and they say, well, let's modify it a little, you know, let's make it non-reproducing. That's the kind of, you know, and that sounds really scary, that level of technology in ignorant human hands right now, right? But yeah, like Katie was saying, the point is just, you know, don't overlay that ability, you know, with today's ignorance, but just appreciate that we have to have courage, and we have to begin to move into this brave new world of starting to experiment. I mean, the life carriers experiment. They're in their laboratory and they try putting things together like this, and it dies. Like, well, okay, well, that didn't work. So they try putting it together like this. Oh, well, that leads to every single human on that planet having cancer. Okay, that doesn't work. I mean, they manipulate stuff at that level. Remember, they even tell you that, you know, they played around with us a little bit and they made it so we get cancer too easily. And so they fixed that, you know, in the subsequent planets. See, I mean, that, right, right. But see, that it's that level. We have to get into that level of playing with things that, you know, where it's consequential.
You know, on that topic, remember when they say somewhere that the Melchizedeks have a plan for, you know, helping, I think it's biologic, I think they're talking about there. Mm-hmm. I always thought that was, you know, the discovery of DNA at that particular time. And now getting on this track of genetics. I mean, the genetics is not the problem right now. The problem is maybe, you know, the way in which some, you know, the people are using it without really knowing what they're doing yet. Mm-hmm. But it's more...
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying.
There's some, you know, awkward sides to it, you know, or repercussions of like their experiments.
And I'm trying to point, you know, get us to trust God, you know, trust the life that the life carriers built it so that we can play with it a lot in our ignorance right now. And it's not going to be as gloom and doom as we can, as our imaginations can picture. We can modify tomatoes a lot. Okay, and we won't all die. And the reason why it feels like we shouldn't is remember who, what part of you is worried about modifying tomatoes. Okay, it's your spiritual part that's worried about modifying, you know, tomatoes. Now, why is your spiritual part worrying about matter? You know, it's like, why do religionists get all worked up about material issues? They're supposed to be about nothing but values. Why are you applying your idealism, the revelators are trying to tell us, to material things? You know, because this, what happens is, if you apply your spiritual consciousness to material things, your spiritual consciousness has no awareness of time. It doesn't believe in time. It thinks time is an intrusion upon goodness. It doesn't, your spiritual consciousness thinks that evolution is evil. It thinks that change is evil. It thinks that tomatoes were made initially divine, and any change in them is going against God. That's what your spiritual consciousness believes. The revelators don't validate that initial assumption. They turn it 180 degrees around. And they tell you that there's not a single plant or animal on this planet right now that's in a finished state. Every single thing has to be completely changed. Tomatoes and light and life will be radically different if they even exist. Right? This is the kind of radical thing that they're trying to tell us. You know, that we don't live in Havona where everything is divine to start with. Right. Everything has to be completely changed. The whole atmosphere has to be completely changed. Every rock, the entire earth has to be completely changed. The oceans have to be completely changed. Everything has to be completely changed. Nothing is what is in the order that needs to be to get to light and life. See, so people who want, I want to live in light and life, it's like you don't know what you're saying. Because I know you want things, you want to pretend that right now is light and life, and everything is just magically exactly as it is right now, but now it's light and life. No, to go from now to light and life, you have to let go of everything. You have to let go of how humans look, how they live, how the earth looks, you have to give up on everything. The fifth typical revelation is so challenging us in this regard, our idealistic consciousness, you know, and trying to teach us that all material idealism is false. Because it takes no account of time. You know, and evolution is creativity in time. It's the Father's way. You were given idealism to apply to spirit things. And if you apply it to any material thing and try to make it an eternal fact now, your thoughts are wholly false. There is no such thing. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things, like the Father's technique to try to teach us this stuff is death. Remember how they talk about death as a technique? We're supposed to notice things like a person spends their whole life trying to apply their idealism to their material stuff, and they get everything absolutely, precisely, perfectly arranged, and they don't let anyone go into their living room or anything. You know, they're just, okay? And then they die. And everyone goes, oh, whatever, and they throw it in the garbage can.
Exactly.
OK? Okay, we all know this, or do we? Okay. I mean, why, you know, to get that death is supposed to be teaching you that when you die, no one cares about how you've arranged the deck chairs on the Titanic. Okay, no one is going to, you know, keep it going eternally, you know. Okay. It's just so important to kind of come to terms with this, you know. Anyway, let's finish her up.
When the life carriers operating on a new world have once succeeded in producing a being with will, with the power of moral decision and spiritual choice, then and there their work terminates. They are through. They may manipulate the evolving life no further. From this point forward, the evolution of living things must proceed in accordance with the endowment of the inherent nature and tendencies which have already been imparted to and established in the planetary life formulas and patterns. The life carriers are not permitted to experiment or to interfere with will. They are not allowed to dominate or arbitrarily influence moral creatures.
See, and that's not because those moral creatures are Havona-like. They're as hopelessly ignorant as they can be made and still be a will creature when it's turned over into their hands. Okay, and why do the life carriers submit to such a demand of them? Because they trust God. Okay. Ignorance is the Father's way, because ignorance is a means to an end. In order to be brilliant, you have to start out ignorant. The inevitabilities. You know, I mean, that contrast is what powers it. And so just, you know, you notice that all those things we were just talking about aren't as tangential as you think. They're trying, you know, that's part of fundamentally what they're trying to teach us here. You know, is that our idealistic consciousness can be really worried about our ignorant will. But beings who are so beyond our recognition aren't. Why aren't they? Why didn't the life carriers rebel when they were told they had to take renunciation vows? Say, are you kidding? You're going to turn that over to Chris Halverson? And you know how clueless he is? I mean, are you out of your mind? No way. No, they trust God that is working through the ignorant Chris Halverson and all of the things that he does in his ignorance with his will. And then when all is said and done, there are no coincidences, there are no accidents. It all comes together in supremacy. We have to trust the ignorant human institutions to be part of a long process. Okay, you know, and it doesn't mean we just shut down. We don't try to, you know, engage the world positively, but we engage the world without fear. You know, we don't rush out to try to do things in the world because we're afraid. We're supposed to have known that for 2,000 years now, and if you want to, you know, improve genetic engineering, don't run out there because you're afraid of genetic engineering. Go out there because you've recognized through the fifth epical revelation that genetic engineering is part of our light and life future, and it needs to be guided, and there's nothing to fear. When we develop chemistry, we feared chemistry. And when we developed, you know, more deeper physics, we feared physics. And now we've developed biology to a level. Now we fear biology. Okay, you know, and it's interesting. We had, you know, when we really got chemistry going, better living through chemistry, we had World War I predicated on chemistry. And when we really got physics going, we had World War II. Okay, culminating with sort of the pinnacle of that with the atomic bomb. Okay, there's a process here. Don't be surprised if there's some really dark things that result from now that we're beginning to play with biology. Okay, but the First and Second World Wars are in the past, and you know they didn't end mankind.
And look how many people fear God.
So, when Jesus said fear not, he means don't be afraid of all the ugly things that are going to happen when you start playing with genetics. That's what he meant when he said that, for instance. Okay, and don't be afraid of, you know, of what the demagogues are going to do with secular totalitarianism. Just face those facts bravely, soldier through them, but don't, you know, and do what you can to help, but don't be afraid. Don't ever be afraid. No real harm can befall you. You know, that's the challenge that's being put upon us. I mean, that's the challenge that was put on us 2,000 years ago. You know, if we're reading the fifth epic of Revelation, we should be rock solid on that. There shouldn't be a single thing we fear. Not one single corporation, not one single, you know, maniacal human. You know, we shouldn't fear any of them. All right. Let's see. So what else? Let me wrap this up here. Okay. Yeah. So this this final issue here of life carriers are not permitted to experiment or interfere with will, and all of the machinations that that implies. But you notice that, you know, remember, there's another paragraph. You know, when they say they are through, well, not quite. There's another paragraph. They can't be totally through. There is another level at which they can participate in this. And I'm just pausing here rather than just reading that, because I want you to see this whole thing came up about, well, what do they mean by manipulate, or what do they mean? And it's a hierarchical thing. They continue to manipulate even today, but in all even more indirect, even more subtle ways. You know, so the universe is always personality managed. So it's not like the life carriers, as part of the planetary government, just, you know, sit there and play cards all day long and ignore us. Okay, they're intimately involved. You know, and they have great knowledge that's helping the planetary government. Okay, so it's just a series of handing over more and more things to those coming up underneath you. You know, and the Father is drawing up will creatures underneath them, and they're handing that over. Okay, so let's wrap it up here.
It says they're not allowed to arbitrarily influence.
Yeah.
Influence is not
right. Oh, good point. Yeah, we should. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's a good point to stress. What, you know, we pointed about arbitrarily. That just means they can do things within the rules that are established, but they're not allowed to set the rules themselves anymore like they used to be able to. Now there's very definitive rules, and they have to stay within them. You know, that's what arbitrarily means. You know, staying within the preset rules, and you don't have any authority to make up rules yourself.
Upon the arrival of a planetary prince, they prepare to leave, though two of the senior carriers and 12 custodians may volunteer by taking temporary renunciation vows to remain indefinitely on the planet as advisors in the matter of the further development and conservation of the life plasm. Two such sons and their 12 associates are now serving on Urantia.
So you see, I mean, right away, they're saying, well, actually, you know, they use words like further development and conservation. You know, see, they're involved, but it's just all the more indirect, and very much in, you know, they don't set any rules anymore. Okay, two such sons and their 12 associates are now serving on Urantia, and they wrote several papers. And they remember all the first papers of Part 3 are written by that crew of 14, right? So we know of their thoughts very intimately. You know, they're in my lap here. Pretty cool, these beings. You know, and you gotta love temporary renunciation vows and remain indefinitely, the contrast. Well, you know, what's a few million years? It's kind of a temporary thing. No, there's one other little, yeah, it's kind of a minor point, but it re-emphasizes a theme that came up several times here, so I want to do this. Okay, you can tell right here they're giving us some, some kind of real specific things that they don't clarify in other spots. See, you got to bring this into play when you interpret other things. Here's a simple example. It gives us specifically that there's two senior carriers, and the ones that, the associates, they're the custodians. Remember, we have these technical terms of senior ones, assistants, and custodians. Okay, but you're going, well, assistant is kind of a general term too. I mean, you're using it specifically here in this paper, but that's kind of a general term that you might want to use too. Yeah, like if you go to the end of paper 62, it says, let me just read that. So they're talking about, you have Anna and Fonta, and we get the messages from on high. These messages from Salvington, Adentian, and Gerasim formally marked the termination of the life carrier's age-long supervision of the planet. For ages, we had been on duty. Remember, this is written by a life carrier. we had been on duty, assisted only by the seven adjutant mind spirits and the master physical controllers. And now, will, the power of choosing to worship and to ascend, having appeared in the evolutionary creatures of the planet, we realized that our work was finished, and our group prepared to depart. Urantia being a life modification world, permission was granted to leave behind two senior carriers and 12 assistants. And I was chosen as one of this group and have ever since been on Urantia. Okay, see? You're going, wait a minute, I think I just found a mistake in the book. No. So you gotta recognize. And you notice here you're saying two senior carriers and 12 custodians. You see they're being very precise in their language. But then here they're just saying that there's the two with some assistants. See, so you've got to interpret. Okay, they don't literally mean the ones that are called assistants. They mean they're just assisting. See, they're with 12 assistants. And technically those assistants are custodians. Okay. I want to stress that because you can easily get, trip over things like that. If you're too rigid, don't be too mechanical about interpreting the book. Right. Yeah. Get a hold of the truth of what's going on before you bring in minutiae of factual distinctions and stuff. You'll find all sorts of errors in the book, quote unquote, that aren't errors. That was not unwise judgment for them to say assistance there. It was a challenge to you to see if you could step back and appreciate the truth of what they're saying, something that you can't teach a computer. A computer would find a contradiction in the book. Can you see it truthfully? So they've purposely done things like that to try to get you to think in a more objective way about what you're reading. All right. Well, that took more than 2 hours to do one section. Here I thought that we'd probably do the Melchizedek Life Carriers tonight. How ignorant I am. All right, so next time, fun stuff again. Melchizedek Life Carriers, all kinds of mind-boggling, brain-twisting things they're going to tell us here that we have to countenance. So let's take a moment here and reflect on our life carriers.